Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments and superstructures, such as the Great Pyramid of Giza or the fabulous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, were lauded, listed, and visited as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. Later, Magnificent Seven celebrated more recent wonders, including the Taj Mahal, or natural phenomena, such as the Grand Canyon or the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? Well, that's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the journalist and broadcaster John Sargent, whose television career included several years as the chief political correspondent of the BBC and political editor of ITN. Though in more recent times, he's probably better known for cutting something of a dash on Strictly Come Dancing, as well as presenting a variety of TV series well away from the cut and thrust of party politics. Now, John, you studied PPE, Philosophy, Politics and Economics at Oxford, the classic first step on the way to becoming an MP or even PM. Did you ever think that the politics was what you were going to go into rather than talking about other people's politics?
No, I thought I did. I mean, but I was very keen to be a reporter.
Yeah.
I wanted to go on adventures. I wanted to race around the world, meet interesting people. I didn't want to be stuck at Westminster. So when I was first suggested that I might go to Westminster, I said, well, I suppose if I had some sort of injury, you know. And they were horrified by that. I mean, they really thought, right, that we'll screw this guy.
All right.
He'll never be allowed to. So when I decided I did want to go to Westminster, lots of obstacles were put in my way. So, but I got there in the end.
So you would have liked to have been like a war reporter or a foreign
correspondent? Yeah. I was a war reporter. I was for 10 years, I was a general reporter. And in that time, I covered, five wars of different sorts, went to 25 countries, did all kinds of stories from, you know, appearing at the Old Bailey to report on murders, to be at Wimbledon to talk about this guy Bjorn Borg. It seemed to be people getting excited about him.
Yeah.
So all these things I did in 10 years, but then eventually I managed to settle down at Westminster for 20 years. So I was 30 years on the staff in all.
Yeah. And do you think you were at least as influential, as reporting these matters as you would have been if you'd been, say, a backbench MP?
I think what I might have done with John Cole, who was the political editor, I think we introduced a different kind of reporting from Westminster, certainly not working from a script the whole time, which they used to.
Yeah.
And certainly trying to say it's a bit more complicated than on the one hand this, on the one hand that.
Yeah.
And that there are things you can say about politics which aren't party political, but which are based upon your experience and knowledge. So I think both of us, John obviously to a greater extent than I did, broke that and made a change there. And I think that was the influence we did have.
Because I once asked this sort of question to Robin Day. So Robin Day, who had stood for Parliament, I think, a couple of times and didn't get in. And then he was this magnificent interrogator on the television. And I said, that's naively, well, you kind of are in a better place being the interrogator, much more important in people's lives that you are there holding everyone to account. But he said, oh, no, reporting on it is one thing. I would much rather have actually been there. And he stood as a liberal. So I'm not quite sure what influence he might have had, even if he'd been, let's say, leader of the Liberal Party in the 1970s or 60s, pretty ineffectual position to be. But, he was absolutely certain that it was a second best thing for him. But that's not for you.
Well, no. I mean, I think there's also a difference between the people who were stuck in studios. I used to be a presenter on Radio 4. I even presented the Today programme for 3 months. But But most of my time, I was a reporter and enjoying it and meeting all these people. Whereas those stuck in Newsnight studios and other things, they never get out. They don't get to Westminster, let alone anywhere else. They've got to do a very skilled job. I'm not denigrating them. But it's not the same as being there, being with Margaret Thatcher in Moscow, being with Margaret Thatcher in Paris. Yeah. You know, these are great moments, which I treasured.
Yes. I might well come on to those moments, but just one other question about your early years in this regard. You were also at Oxford, a bit of a comedian, a performer. You worked in a review with Alan Bennett. So that's another path you might have gone down. And obviously you've obviously got a sense of humour, but might you have been like an Alan Bennett, a comedian or a writer or a...
I had the choice at the end of my time at Oxford, which I spent either making jokes or writing jokes or being serious. And I tried to keep that balance ever since. I got a job with Reuters, all lined up, and I then went to Edinburgh to the festival and appeared in the Oxford Review. And one night, Alan Bennett was there.
Yeah.
And the next morning, he collected us all together and suddenly turned to me in front of all these people desperate to get into show business and said, "Would you like to be in my television comedy series?"
Yeah.
And there's an awful hush. And I said, "Well, I'm not sure about that because I've got this job lined up."
Mm.
So I did do that, and we had a fantastically successful run in his only sketch show on television called On the Margin. And it was wonderful and marvellous. But I again had to decide, look, what am I going to do?
Yes.
And I wanted to be a journalist. And so I went to work on the Liverpool Echo as a reporter.
So you dashed, not sure it's a very full answer, but I haven't quite answered the essence of my question, which is, you know, do you think you could have had a career taking that first step into comedy?
I could have had a career. I don't think I'd been very good at it. I certainly wasn't as funny as Alan. I mean, God, that was an example of...
Well, that's a high bar.
Don't try and go this way.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, my brother was an actor and hadn't been very successful as an actor. So I had plenty of warnings of, you know, be careful. Oh.
Okay, well, let's go on to your first wonder, which... links to that reasonably well. What is the first wonder?
The first wonder is the BBC. Now, this isn't like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon or one of the famous ancient wonders of the world, but it is a wonder, and it was certainly a wonder to me. It gave me a fantastic career. So there's a personal element. You say my personal wonders.
Yeah.
So I'm allowed to choose eccentrically the BBC with all its manifold faults, but with all its magnificent strengths.
And you've put it in terms of it gave a career to you, but are you appreciating the BBC as an employee of it or as a viewer or listener or all of those?
I think it's all of them. No, I mean, I think that, you know, I very much wanted to work in all the departments of the BBC. I put that on my first application form. They turned me down immediately. You know, we can't have people just wanting to work for the BBC. But, you know, we must have people obsessed by some aspect of the work.
Oh, it's like applying for university these days. You have to say that the only thing you've ever wanted to study was economics with accounts. And
so if I'd said I want to be a makeup artist, they'd have perhaps been a bit surprised in those days.
Yeah.
But they would have been more interested in that than me saying, I just want to work anywhere. I want to work, you know, for the BBC.
Yeah.
But it gave me lots of opportunities, not just to be funny later on, and my first job was with the Alan Bennett series, but to go to wars and to meet people, to go to extraordinary places, and to work in almost every single department of the BBC. So at the end of my 30 years, I was jolly pleased to have done my 30 years, and my manager said to me, "This will interest you," and he passed across the table a brown envelope. Mm. And he said, "This will interest you." And so I said, "Oh, yes." I opened it up, and it was the reference that Alan Bennett had given me 30 years before.
Okay.
And so I said, "Wow, that's wonderful. Can I have this?" And they said, "No, John, it's a copy." It's just a copy. So somewhere in the archive is the real one.
And what does it say?
And it just says that I'm fun and that I would be better at reporting than anyone that Alan heard normally on the radio reporting. And that I should definitely be employed.
So doing a sketch show at Edinburgh and getting in with Alan Bennett in that sense did help you.
Perhaps. It was peculiar.
Mm.
And I was a bit embarrassed about the whole thing. I mean, that's why I'd worked so seriously in Liverpool as a journalist trainee. But no, the BBC were quite ready to think, oh, there's something about this bloke.
Mm.
You know, and of course, what they're really after, and this is correct, is that most of the people that work as television reporters have had some sort of dramatic experience, that as amateurs and various things, because you've got to have dramatic presence. You've got to be able to stand up on a stage and people either want to look at you or can't help but look at you.
Mm.
In my case, it was can't help but look at you. So that you know, you need that. If you've got nothing about you,
yeah.
If you're just simply a bloke reciting stuff,
yes,
with no flair, you're not going to make it as a BBC correspondent.
You did mention in passing there was that very dramatic moment with Margaret Thatcher, where the point of time when she was close to being, well, resigning or losing office. And talk us through that again. You were trying to grab an interview with her.
Yeah, no, the thing, I had to go back just one step further. I went to Moscow with her when she was meeting Gorbachev in Moscow for the first time. Mm. And it was on an RAF plane, so the food was much better. Wonderful food.
Yeah.
You know, with vintage wines and the whole thing.
I'm not sure that follows in an ordinary mind. No, because it's an RAF plane,
know,
you get better
but that's
food.
It.
Fair
it
enough.
Does, anyway,
yeah.
VIP RAF flight, much better than plastic jobs. Anyway,
So
I'm sitting down for a meal, and we're told by Burningham that she's not going to come down and see you for a while, so you can get on with your food. He's very charming.
He was that rather irascible press
secretary.
Oh, yeah.
So I started this wonderful meal, and Margaret Thatcher appeared at my side. Mm. So I stood up, and all the food and what have you went on the floor.
Mm.
And Margaret Thatcher, typical her, rushed forward, threw herself onto the ground, and turned to me and said, "You stay where you are. I'll sort this out." Well, now, that's typical her. She had no sense of humour, but she could be playful.
Yes.
But it also meant from then on, she knew exactly who I was. I was the guy that made a fool of himself.
He was the idiot who couldn't...
I was the idiot from the BBC.
Yes. Yeah.
So when we were outside the embassy...
And this is in
this is
Brussels?
This is 1990 in Paris Embassy.
Paris.
British Embassy in Paris.
Sorry, yeah.
She had heard that she'd not done well enough in the ballot of MPs against Michael Heseltine to avoid a second ballot.
Yeah.
So we knew she was in dead trouble.
She was damaged.
And I thought that she's not going to come out and talk now. She'll be consulting and all that kind of thing. And someone from Number 10 said, that's it. So when the newsreader, Peter Sissons, turned to me and said, "John, well, what's the reaction been to this result, you know, in Paris?" I then rambled on saying she won't be coming out.
Mm.
And then someone jumped up in front of me and I thought, that's a bit odd. What's going on?
Mm.
And I longed to look behind. I looked behind. And, of course, there was Margaret Thatcher and Burningham pushing their way past me. Burningham hit me because he wanted to get her past me so she would talk to all the reporters behind the crash barriers. But they were denied that. I got my BBC scoop, so it was the best moment in my career because she then commented on the results. 2 days later, she resigned.
Yeah.
So it made my career and it wrecked hers.
Well, at least you didn't spill any food on air, so you're on top of the. Well, look, but you're quite rightly talking about your big moments in your career, and the BBC's part of that.
Mm.
But people listening to this, some of them will go, "Yes, the BBC's a fine institution," but other people will be going, "No, it's finished. It's hopeless.
It's awful.
It's useless. We don't want to pay 150 or so
That's
quid
it, poll
for
tax.
Yeah, all that kind of thing." So, do you think it's got a future? It's 100 years old.
100 years old.
And but has it got another 100 years? Has it got another 10 years?
No, but whenever they think of either abolishing it or changing the system, they think, we're sort of stuck with this. And everybody really, I think most people would accept anyway, that life in Britain is much better with the BBC than without it. So it's all very well saying, I hate them, they're biased, and it's all ghastly, and why don't they put me on, and various other questions that people raise. In practice, though, it has been such an enormous force for good, with all its failings and all its idiosyncrasies and its terrible management. It has, in fact, produced some wonderful, wonderful programmes. And now it's produced a demigod, David Attenborough.
And the other thing that may spell its doom is just the technological advances. I know there have been different ones. ITV came along, multi-channels came along. But now, in terms of drama, there's Netflix producing stuff, there's Apple, all sorts of things.
But not with the range. Curiously enough, what all this has shown is that the BBC is actually quite good value for money. I mean, nobody says that.
Yeah.
But the amount of people who spend on these streaming things...
Yes.
It's incredible. And the BBC, of course, has the range. All the little local radio stations, all the language services, all the orchestras, five orchestras. Yeah. And when people began to think a bit about that, they think, well, it would be such a chunk out of our lives. Yeah. If you just make it a subscription service, you've got to people hate new taxes. It's amazing what old taxes they'll put up with. And from that point of view, isn't it extraordinary the license fee goes on the poll tax?
Well, before we leave the BBC, just as a suggestion that I've made myself many times and got nowhere with, maybe it's the license fee itself which is the problem. It's a government-funded institution, and that it's a way of kind of disguising that. You have this special license fee, which was appropriate when you were buying into it. But you could say it's just going to be provided out of general taxation. Then people wouldn't be obsessive. At the moment, people don't say, why am I paying £50 every year for libraries that I don't use, or £10, or what have we done? No one's got any idea how much we spend on most things. But you could make that change.
You could, but that's true about all sorts of things, lotteries and all sorts of odd ways people have of thinking they're going to be in luck and make money or not make money. People's attitude to money and paying
is
odd.
But for some people, 150 or is a lot of money. To other people, they don't notice it, and they wouldn't notice it if it was coming out of their income tax.
Sure, but you then essentially you're talking about what do most people want out of it all, and most people are getting an enormous amount out of the BBC, and they know it.
All right, so that's your first wonder of the
world.
That's
my wonder.
British Broadcasting Corporation.
Exactly. And my role in it.
Yeah. A spontaneous round of applause for one of the most popular leaders this country's ever had. I'm sure you agree. So Margaret Thatcher, why?
Yeah. Well, everyone's got their reasons. My reasons are very personal.
Yes.
Now, there are times when I'm at work and people get in the way, they shout at you, they wave behind you when you're doing pieces to camera, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a particular problem with Margaret Thatcher because I'm often working and she was often, for one reason or another, getting in the way and causing me difficulties.
There is a particular example. I don't know if you remember it.
No.
But your second wonder is perhaps a more traditional wonder.
Yes, more traditional wonder. I'm going to choose the Grand Canyon.
Mm.
Now, the point about these sorts of famous wonders, if you like, is it depends very much on your mood.
Yes.
Now, when I was in my gap year, I went to America, arriving with £30 and working as an accountant, would you believe it, in a concrete plant. But anyway,
I was there for
7 months
yes.
and had a fantastic series of adventures, which ended up with me being present in the crowd when Martin Luther King made his I Have a Dream speech. But that was right at the end of the 7 months.
Okay.
Before that, I went all over America with two other students that I met, and we went to Arizona. But before that, we'd been through the horrible apartheid of the southern states, the tensions over race, because this was in 1963. It was a very political moment. But then we got to Arizona and we arrived at the Grand Canyon. And I have to say, all this politics whirring around in my head, as it has done for the whole of my life almost, to see the Grand Canyon just took my breath away. And I look back on it, I think, God, that is, when you're talking about billions of years and talking about a little river that goes through a plateau, and then after 50 million years or something, it then creates this enormous canyon, which is nearly 300 miles long, nearly 20 miles wide, and more than a mile deep.
Yeah.
If that takes you away from thinking about race and politics and all the rest of it, you just think, oh, my goodness me. What a fantastic sight. And I was 19 years old, and I just thought, this is, about grand, this is a wonder of the world.
So it is, well, it certainly is a wonder of the world, but it is intertwined, clearly, from what you're saying, with the age you were. The early 60s in America was a very different place from now, very different from Britain, so it was more of a journey to go from here to there in those days.
Yeah, and can you imagine? My first hamburger, my first pizza.
Yes.
You know, I mean, so those sorts of things, you thought, God, what an extraordinary place.
The whole place was a wonder of the world in that sense.
So you're wrapped up, and then this amazing political tension that's going on, and then suddenly the Grand Canyon, it's completely different. Hooray! Yeah. You know, the elation, and then you go down to the Grand Canyon. It took me hours, and my companions too. We got about a third of the way down.
But how are you doing that? Are you walking, driving?
Walking down.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see one of the very early expeditions down there in the 18th century or something. They only got a third of the way down.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got about a third of the way down. We then went back up. And I remember drinking pints and pints and pints of water.
Yeah.
You know, and you just thought, what a... I can still feel it now. I can feel the water. I can still feel the excitement, the colours of the Grand Canyon. There were funny ochres and yes. all sorts of oranges and sort of strange browns. And and there's great five different climatic zones or something.
Yes, it's fantastic. Well, odd enough, we don't get many duplications of wonders in the ones I've done so far of these. A couple of dozen, but Trevor MacDonald, who very yes. much Sir Trevor MacDonald, who works in your area, in that yes. he chose the Grand Canyon as well. So there must be something about news hounds of a certain vintage, if I may put it like that,
yeah.
who are struck by the Grand Canyon.
I think we just, you know, as we the comparison is probably right, probably a fair comparison. We get stuck into so much detail to do with men and politics and women and. How things are and issues and all that and taxation to suddenly find this sort of mind-blowing experience which knocks us completely into a different world.
Yes.
That's one of the things about these. It's funny, these wonders of the world, it's really almost wonders out of this world.
Yeah.
You know, that they're sort of, they're not part of your ordinary experience.
But you mentioned there that part of this trip or this time in America got you to be there when Martin Luther King was making his very famous speech. So could you tell me about that?
Well, I mean, I was with a family who were frankly racist from the South. And they yeah. said, are you going into, are you going downtown? And I said, I was going downtown. But they didn't say what for. And I knew the March on Washington was taking place. And there were 250,000 people there. And there was speech after speech, and there was singing, and Mahalia Jackson, all sorts of people were going on about things. Most people there black. And suddenly, speaker number 17 or something stood up. A young bloke, 34 years old, didn't know who he was, but I knew about, he was a Baptist preacher, I knew that.
Yeah.
And my father had been a preacher, so I knew quite a bit about how do you make the occasion work. I didn't know that someone said to him, go on, Martin, and give them my eye of a dream.
Yeah, because it's a speech he'd made before, hadn't he?
Yeah, speeches he'd made before. So someone said, go on, give them the eye of a dream line. Mm. And he then launched into it. And, of course, it was just electric. Oh, goodness me.
Yeah.
And you did feel the hairs going up on the back of your neck. And you thought there was something very... And also what you don't get from the black and white newsreels of the time is you don't get this extraordinary sense of it being like a... Like a Baptist church, there are 250,000 people there in front of the Lincoln Memorial, but they're all shouting and he's talking about places they know and they're saying, oh yeah,
yeah,
and that, so all that's going on between the crowd and the preacher, and that's one of the many reasons why we're all electrified by it.
Yeah, so you were what in the crowd or standing back or how far away from him were you?
I should think I was a few hundred yards from him, and I was on one side of. Of the one side of that extraordinary lake in front of Congress,
right?
And so I know where I was. So whenever the news will come on, I look to see if I can be seen.
Yeah.
And someone very kindly, I got to know someone who did colorization, and they've given me a picture of the crowd colorized, and I still can't see.
You can't pick yourself up. So you might have been sort of red-faced from all your journeying around the Grand Canyon.
Exactly.
And so, but this is before you were a reporter, perhaps before even at university.
Isn't it paradoxically? Yeah. But of course, what drove me there is the typical reporter's instinct. I wanted to be there for the story.
Yes.
I didn't know it was going to be that big.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, this is quite a moment.
But you knew this was the speech to,
and
to
afterwards,
remember?
Afterwards, of course, I knew, yes. This, and then curiously, the speech got much more famous once you'd been killed.
Yes.
So it's one of those curiosities about...
When you went back to the racist family you were staying with, did you say, I went along, there's a huge crowd, this fantastic speech.
I made
from this...
absolutely no comment on it.
And were they not interested?
No, they were very interested.
Yeah.
And they were on the edge of their seats as to what had gone on and so on, but we did not discuss it.
All right. Sounds like a very memorable trip for all sorts of reasons.
It was very memorable.
Yeah, all right, well, that's...
And a very happy period.
Yes, happy period in your life.
Happiest period of my life.
Yes, happy days when you're 19, you're travelling abroad, you've seen sights.
And you've got into Oxford.
And you got into Oxford.
So you don't need to worry about that. You know, your future to that extent is just, what a time.
I have a dream that my four little children one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Let's go on to your third wonder, though, if we may.
Right. My third wonder is English churches. Now, that may sound rather serious, but it's not. It's places and people and all sorts of associations that I have. And I usually go with my wife and we go to look around church, a church crawl. Some people call it about pub crawls,
yes.
But you go church crawl. And to do that properly, you need to have one of the Pevsner volumes.
Right.
These are the buildings of England.
Yeah.
Now, often it's full of jargon, and I'll read you one of the descriptions. Mm-hmm. It's the only bit of notes I've got, so I'm allowed
to read
this.
All right, well, it's very good of you to come armed with notes.
The village is unforgettable, its thatched ironstone cottages engulfed in gardens in a valley encircled by trees. The Norman church was rebuilt in the 13th century. Opposite the churchyard entrance is the plain stone vicarage, mostly of 1781, with a shabby porch. Not sure I like the shabby porch, because, of course, that was our home. That's where I was brought up as a child, and my father was the vicar of Great Tew.
Right, now that's so an extraordinary village, from that description, but it's known to be. It's an unusual village, isn't it?
It is an unusual village, and it's got genuine thatched cottages, and it's lovely, and I think that the Beckhams and various people now have moved into that area.
Yes.
I don't know. They probably brought down the whole tone of it. But when I was there...
Well, I don't know.
It was a lovely...
Was it owned by a sort of local lord of the manor?
It was. Yeah. And it was then taken over by his estate manager. But no, for me, it was... there were very few cars. Mm. And it was absolutely idyllic. And I went to the local school. So there were 30 kids. We had a school teacher... And we were there for 6 years, so we were spread up. We were divided into groups of five. So it was a group of five. She talked to us. Say, I'm talking to you now.
Yes.
And then your next year group would be alongside that, alongside that, in one schoolroom.
Right. A proper village school.
And she was in charge, and she was a magnificent woman. She lived to more than 100.
Yeah.
But that's how I was taught from the age of five. The age of 11, where I got the 11 plus, and other things happened to me.
And then you went off to a grander school after that.
I did, because my father was, as well as being the vicar, taught at actually grander. I went to a grim public school. I won't, perhaps better not name it, it's too unhappy for them. They were dreadful. And I was the youngest boy in the school for 2 years.
All right.
So that didn't help.
Yeah.
Then my father was sacked from that and sacked from his position at Great Tew by a dreadful woman who said he wasn't paying enough attention to the parish.
Right.
So he then went from there to a famous school now, Millfield.
Yes.
And the headmaster said, would you got any sons if they're bright enough? They can come here. And so for £100 a year, I went to the most expensive school in England at the time, Millfield in Somerset.
Thanks to your father being a teacher
there. Thanks to my father being
Yes, and the ups teacher. And downs of his career. Mm. So did that... change you, do you think, going in a village school with, you know, just a few people, you might have come out as emerged as something different from somebody who goes to, albeit your father didn't have to pay so much, still a very grand school to go to.
Yeah, no, I think it was difficult, but I was good at passing exams, and that's why I was there.
Yes.
And there were lots of people there who were good at sport.
Yeah.
They sent, I think, in the last Olympics, there were 11 Millfield pupils competing. No, so they're still an amazing sporting school, and they were then. And I was one of a small group of people whose job it was to pass exams,
which
I did. And I studied, would you believe it, for 4 years, the last 4 years, maths, physics were my only subjects pretty well. Maths and physics, applied maths, pure maths and physics.
Right.
And I took that in at A level 3 times and at S level, getting slowly worse marks.
But it can't be too bad because you got to Oxford in due course.
No,
you didn't stick with physics or maths.
I knew an awful lot of maths and physics.
Yes, but as I say, you did earlier, you did philosophy, politics and economics, which is obviously a bit of maths and economics, but for the rest, it's more, I don't know, analysis, opinions, use of language rather than numbers.
Yeah, but also with all those things, the science things, I think what it gave me was the capacity anyway to be detached. If you're a political correspondent, you're outside number 10, what are you meant to say? Well, the main thing to do is to clear the noise away from your head of all the other things you might say and come out with something quite simple which can be understood.
Yeah. So, but going back to the churches, you do church called, but do you... Would you take in St. Paul's Cathedral, you know, grand places like that, or you only really like village churches towers and things?
It's the village churches you just feel, particularly now, that they've so suffered from, well, they've suffered from the pandemic, but they suffer because people close them now.
Yeah.
And you just sort of feel, oh, that really is in decline.
Yeah.
And when I said to Alan Bennett that I might not join him in the television comedy series, he said, oh, why not? And I said, my father would be very cross. And he said, why is that? And I said, well, because of the sermon sketch in Beyond the Fringe that Alan was famous for.
Yeah.
And I said, my father was a clergyman, and he regards you as personally responsible for the decline of the Church of England. And so Alan said, oh, dear. Well, what does your mother think? It all sort of fits in with a feeling very much of, you know, my dad and churches and life in great too. So for me, it's not just sort of, oh, let's go around and find out what's going on. It's reliving a sort of a large chunk of my mental life, which is, of course, forever in great too.
And a sort of idyllic part of your childhood.
Yeah.
And are you religious? And are you there to worship God as well?
No, unfortunately, no. I worship the buildings. Don't worship God, I'm afraid. I ought to, but I felt I'd done enough of that by the time I was 30. I thought, you know, going to church twice on a Sunday and all that, I thought it's quite enough now.
But anyway, it doesn't stop you going to the churches.
And marvelling in them and encouraging other people to go.
Yeah, and so it's the smell of them, the feel of them, the look of them, and the history of them. Would you say you're very, in that sense, very much in love with sort of the Englishness of your life?
And you know, it's from that point of view, is it another awful aspect of growing old? You get more patriotic, don't you? You get more sort of, this is my area, this is my country, and I love it.
All right.
Sort of thing.
Well, that may lead us to your next wonder then. So what's your fourth wonder?
The next wonder very much does fit that. And, of course, it fits both with my childhood dreams and excitements and with my ability to work for it in documentary films, because I've chosen the Spitfire.
Yes.
And that's because, well, why is it? It's because it's just one of those crazy things which ought to frighten you. And if I've had a Spitfire, part of the filming, flying right over my head at 400 miles an hour, and it can look terrifying.
Yeah.
And then when it goes up in the sky, it sort of sighs its way up in the sky, you think, oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course, for lots of people, it's all of those things. And it's part of the Second World War story. I was born in 1944 at the end of the war. But when I was young, all these memoirs were coming out about pilots and we were making these models of Spitfires. So
you must have had an Airfix kit of a
Spitfire. Well, yes, a Keelcraft, not an Airfix. Oh, right. Because we actually made them in balsa.
I don't want to lower the tone.
And paper with dope on it.
Yeah.
No, but all that, you see, is pretty powerful imagery.
Mm.
And to then find, as I then did, that, how old was I? I don't know. I was not that long ago. I was allowed to fly a Spitfire. Because I had learnt to fly gliders and powered planes and got a private pilot's license when I was a teenager,
right?
With the RAF, all paid for by the RAF.
Yeah.
And so when I was then making programs later on in recent years, allowed to make programs, to do a Spitfire program and then being allowed to fly it.
And what was it like to fly?
Well, it was just absolutely, it was just wonderful.
Mm.
Because one of the Spitfire pilots once described it as being like a body armor that you put round you.
Yeah.
You're so tight within it.
Well, I have an awkward question I want to ask about that.
That I was too fat.
I didn't want to put it like that. I was just saying, if, because of the age you are, and presumably most Spitfire pilots would have been, I don't know, in their early 20s, and everybody's a bit slimmer. Well, most people are a bit slimmer in their 20s.
Yes, but I think
it was still, you would still get in and out. And...
No, I think that, no, the idea that, no, fatism, I have to admit, all the ones I met of the people who were pilots in the Second World War, they are remarkably trim, even the old ones of 90.
Yes.
You know, the very old ones.
Yeah.
So that is a, you're quite right. It's a, that's a horrible point to make, though, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I'll tell you why it came to mind, because I thought of an idea for a television programme too late, for all sorts of reasons, too late. But I don't think I ever could have had it on time because of when I started to do television. But to do a programme called What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? And there could be a whole variety of things, but one of those could be if your father had flown. My father happened to fly in the RAF, not in Spitfires as it happens, but just the idea of me as a bit older, or him much older, obviously clambering in and out of, in his case, Wellingtons, but it could be done with, you know, Wellington aircraft. It could be done with a Spitfire to see, well, what was it like, you know, and you've, in a sense, done that. Aspect of the programme by flying in a Spitfire.
And I had, there was a co-pilot, I'm going to say a 27-year-old, but he just said, you have control.
Because yes.
he knew I knew the basics of flying. But it was a terrific thing to do. And I can see that I once had a plan once to rebuild Spitfires, 3D printing. You think, well, look, we've got all the
right.
charts and maps and bits and pieces. Sure, we could rebuild a Spitfire and make it exactly right.
Yeah.
And I was talking to an engineer about this, and he said, yes, it would work, you know, you could do that, but I tell you what, it wouldn't sound the same.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's the key
part
to
it. Part of it,
Merlin, to get those iron, cast iron engines.
Yes.
Merlin engines. The noise of that is what people like so much. So, yes, you could build a 3D with a 3D printing.
Well,
it wouldn't sound right.
If you were, let's say, 20 years older, you almost certainly would have been a participant in the war. Is a bit of you that thinks you, I mean, it seems a weird thing to say about a war, but you missed the excitement of being participating in what has turned out to be a very important war to have fought and won?
Yes, no, I very much felt that. I was extremely annoyed to have missed it and, you know, almost sort of expressed it in those terms.
Yeah.
And long for some of these aircraft, because we lived near an airfield, they were training planes. I thought, why can't one of them crash at least, and I could then run across and look at all the instruments. And
yes.
Now, I was obsessed by aircraft.
Oh, right.
So it was when I'm choosing the Spitfire, it's just one of many, really.
But the war in that sense loomed large in your.
Yes,
growing up.
Yes, and when I recently sometimes write travel pieces for the Daily Mail, and they agreed to send me to Colditz, which was just a dream. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, that was just perfect.
Yes.
To see the room where Douglas Bader was kept.
Yes.
And where he would be up two flights of stairs, so he'd be carried up by one of the junior characters in Colditz. They'd carry Douglas Bader up the stairs. All that stuff to me is it's meat and two veg, and it's just perfect food.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's go on to your next wonder, if we may.
Right, the next wonder are British canals and waterways. Now, in a way, that's a sort of a similar idea of how can you... you know, rid your mind of all this politics and junk that you normally get on, you know, confused with, you're stuck at home. How do you get to grips with the British countryside? Well, so it's the same sort of idea as the churches. Well, just go along the canals and waterways.
Well, we are, in a sense, doing a review of some of your old TV, or not your old, but your TV successes with the Spitfire. Now you've gone on to British Canals and Waterways. So as people may have seen you...
barging around Britain.
Barging around Britain, going slowly, as is the way of canal travel, on a barge. Does that mean you were always very interested in canals and somebody spotted this and said, we'll get you to do that programme? Or has your interest been sparked by the fact that a TV company wanted to put you on a barge and you took to it once you got there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I tell you what, I was always keen on messing about in boats. So any kind of boat, including sailing, I'd always go sailing over in the summer with my brother, was very much part of my life, and taking my children to the Lake District and having the whole Arthur Ransom experience. So from that point of view, I was very wedded to sort of the waterways and rivers aspect and the messing about in boats aspect.
Yes.
And when I was asked, would I do this programme about canals? And of course, they were worried about the title. That people were saying, oh, no, experts will call them narrow boats. You see, you can't have barges. They're not barges. They're narrow boats. So I thought, oh, yeah, narrow boats round Britain. That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
What a great title. So I managed to get them to agree to barging round Britain. I also wanted the idea that I was barging round Britain. I was not a slim, narrow boat cruising quietly the waters. I was barging.
But so messing around in boats on a lake or the sea is full of excitements and the wind picking up and capsizing and arriving. Whereas on a canal, you know where you're going. You know you're not going to get there very quickly because there'll be locks in between.
The curious thing is that, you know, if you're on a narrow boat and you're going at 4 miles an hour and you pass a road full of speeding cars, you immediately think, actually, I'm in a better position.
Yes.
And it's one of those curious sort of aspects of the mode of travel. If you like it, the slowness of it is not so important because you're forced to concentrate on all sorts of other things, the lie of the land, whether or not where is the water level? Because, of course, if a canal is above the water level, it may dry out in the summer.
Yeah.
So the whole way it's built and the way that you're then looking at the land because you're thinking, so if they were building this now, how would they do it? And why did it have to go like that? And why didn't they just put in lots of locks and go over mountains? Why did they go through tunnels?
Yes.
And all those sorts of things. All those things come to mind. And it also just means that you're not racing about being neurotic, which you normally are. Yes. And that's similar on a boat. You've got so many things to do on a sailing boat that it puts other thoughts aside. I think that's the key to it. That's key to all relaxation, isn't it? Not obsessing with things that you're worried about daily, things, have I done this in time? I still dream about missing stories and arriving completely unbriefed on some news story. So that's still in my still in my dream nightmares.
You know? So do you miss not being on the day-to-day reporting?
I only miss it when I'm watching and they make some ghastly mistake or they don't ask the right question.
And you're ready hand on the shoulder to say, we've all nearly done that.
We've all nearly done that. We're just thinking, oh, no, for goodness sake, just ask that. Or don't do that. You know, say to Djokovic, did you have a test or something?
Yes, yeah.
And don't just ramble on about something else.
Yeah.
And don't just go over the past with what we know about. Think of some new angle which hasn't been answered, and then ask it with considerable force, if necessary, and if necessary, repeat it.
When those very big things involving, you know, prime ministers coming and going, governments falling or not falling, I sort of sense there is a feeling you'd really like to be there amongst it.
I'm always there. No, in my spirit, I'm always there. I'm often following it. The joy of being sort of semi-retired as I am now is that all this stuff comes into you at home.
I mean,
you can follow every news conference, everything that's happened in the House of Commons. When I first went to the House of Commons, we had to write it all down, rush out and describe it. There were no broadcasting.
Yeah, so that's an absurd thing to remember now, that it wasn't possible.
It wasn't possible. And there's endless news conferences and follow-ups and being able to record it on your own machine and play that back and...
Yeah.
Or did they really say that?
Well, we've discussed one high point of your career, but what in general terms is if you ask a great question, what are you aiming at? A question that embarrasses the politician or just releases some information that we didn't have or shows the story in a completely different light? What's the real aim?
Well, I'll give you one example, which is not a political one, but I was in Northern Ireland when they announced they weren't going to have the death penalty anymore for terrorists.
Right.
And I got into a car with somebody, roared off to Crumlin Road Jail outside. There was a woman outside, and I rushed up to her with my tape recorder, and I said, sorry, but why are you here? And she said, my son is inside, and I now know that he won't die. And so on.
Right.
So that interview, which I suppose went on for about no more than 3 or 4 minutes, I think, but covering the main points.
Yeah.
When did you hear? What about this? What did he do? And so all the questions, nothing can be prepared.
Yeah.
But I as I rushed back to Broadcasting House in Belfast, I thought, God, this is really quite something. It's a great moment.
Mm.
You know, it's a great moment for her. I've got it there. It's not me being horrible. It's not me being asking awkward questions. We've got something which is just so sort of vital and so profound.
Yes.
And those are the great moments for me. And if you say, oh, do people remember you about that? No. Does everyone say, do you remember that time when you interviewed? Yeah. No one has ever, ever said to me, I heard the interview you gave to the woman. No,
they don't remember the great interviews. They tend to remember,
things that have gone wrong.
Things go wrong, yes. Nonetheless, we've got quite a picture, I suppose, of you emerging: English churches, British canals, the Spitfire.
This is yes, you, no, that's good. You are the Royal Britannia.
You are the most patriotic person so far.
There's a stone train going back to the quarries.
So they'll be picking up stone and coming back here.
That's right.
So they're doing the job that we would have done on these old boats.
Absolutely, yeah.
Your sixth wonder takes us at least out of Britain.
Yes, it takes out of Britain, and so it ought to, because a lot of my best times have been spent abroad.
Yeah.
And, of course, I could have chosen the Taj Mahal, which I've seen twice. You could go on about all sorts of things.
Yes.
But no, I've chosen the Maigret novels of Georges Simenon.
Right, okay.
And there are 75 of them.
Yeah.
And some people, the reason why I've studied them, and I mean studied them for 40 years, is to improve my French. I was briefly the Paris correspondent of the BBC, very briefly, and it's unfinished business. So even now, I am struggling. I never read them in English.
Right.
I always read them, but I do it on an iPad or a fancy machine.
Yes.
So whenever I want a translation, I press a button.
So you press
a button,
idea,
up comes a word, up comes a phrase.
Yes.
You may say, but hasn't my French improved over the years? The answer is not very much.
Well, I'm already impressed. I don't know why I hadn't reapplied my mind to this. I kind of imagined you'd been reading them in English, but of course, they're written in French, and of course, you're not the sort of person who's going to. I'm sure you read War and Peace in Russian
you
as well.
You do difficult things, is the point.
Yes.
Yeah. You try and do difficult things. All right.
But other than the learning of English or other than the learning of French or the topping up of your vocabulary and so forth, what is it about Maigret novels? He's a pretty well-known figure, I suppose. I think he's Belgian, wasn't he, Georges Simenon?
Yes,
but it's set in Paris.
Set in Paris.
So he's, a little bit like the French Sherlock Holmes. He's been sometimes compared to, but he is a police officer.
Yeah, no, he's a police officer, commissaire, but he's also much more interested, really, in the people than the outcome. I mean, he's meant to be there to solve crime, but actually he's not. He's really trying to solve human conundrums and personalities and find out about how people really behave.
Mm.
And that's the fascination of it. But what makes it more extraordinary is that he was such a rogue, Simenon.
Mm.
And he once bragged about having sex with 10,000 women.
10,000?
Yeah, 10,000.
How did he find time to write all these novels then?
Well, I know. And you think, these novels are all about, and these Maigret novels are all about this very steadfast, the relationship between Monsieur and Madame Maigret is profound and deep and wonderful.
Yes.
And it's all jolly. And while all this was going on, Simenon had these paid for it. And his second wife was asked about this 10,000 figure.
Yeah.
And she said that was not the case. It was nearer 1,200. And so the whole sort of idea that Simenon himself is living, he had a couple of dozen pseudonyms he wrote under, But he's living an extraordinary life where it's not write about yourself and write about your own feelings. Yeah. It's make up an elaborate system, 75 novels, Maigret novels,
yes,
where he, you know, wouldn't have had sex with anybody apart from Madame Maigret on a yeah. good day.
So you're attracted to that side of it as
yeah.
well?
So you've always got to know, when was the story written? You know, what stage in his life was it? So you need to know more background. But the key thing is to realise that, you know, he's living this complete, utter fantasy.
Yeah.
In these novels. And that gives them a sort of curious... Again, we're talking about, are these wonders of the world, wonders of the world? No, they're outside the world, aren't they? They're outside
sure,
the world.
Yeah.
And these Maigret novels, from that point of view, the criterion fits precisely. That's why these are, in my view, personally... Yeah. These are a wonder of the world.
Well, what I was going to ask you, maybe this is an irrelevant question, but because I think I understand what you're saying about Georges Simenon and Maigret, but they are crime novels, and there are a lot of crime authors. So do you read either the old ones like Conan Doyle or Agatha Christie, or you know, more up to date people, of which there, you know, is Harlan Coben, Ian Rankin, Val McDermott, Chris Brookmeyer, Patricia Cornwell. I'm just rattling off the authors yeah. like that who I've interviewed in the last few months.
Well, I know. If I was interviewing them, I certainly would read them.
Yes.
No, I tend not to. But then it's part of this obsession with reading this thing in French and educating me.
Yeah.
You see, it's that's complicated. I tend to read, I have to admit, nonfiction.
Yes.
Most of the books I read
right.
are books on history, books sometimes on music, but they're not. I don't read that many novels. I read yeah. some novels.
But if it was just French you were topping up your knowledge of, you could move on to other French novelists and
yeah.
other French, I don't yeah. know how many other, well, you know, crime novelists there are. I'm sure there must be plenty published
yeah,
in France.
There's a man called Michel Houellebecq, who is yeah. a famous sort of French writer, and I'm just at the moment reading his latest novel.
Yeah.
So, but again, I'm reading it in French with difficulty.
All right. Well, we've got to hurry now because we've got one
sure.
more, the final wonder of the world, according to John Sargent.
Yeah.
So what is your seventh wonder?
Well, it's
wonder?
The treasures of Tutankhamun. Now, you can yeah. call it King Tut or anything you like, but we know that death mask.
Yes.
And it is small in real life. I've seen it several times.
Yeah.
I first went to the Cairo Museum when I was three, and I said, family story, I want Dat Labbit looking at an alabaster elk from the Trace of Tutankhamun. I went when I was older. and actually several times. The last time I went, I was making a film actually in Luxor and also in Cairo and with Dan Snow.
Mm.
And all the other people on the team had seen the treasures because it was largely about that.
Yeah.
For some reason, I wasn't in those scenes. I wonder why that was. Anyway, good old Dan.
Hey, you got a trip out of it.
I'm not complaining about it. It's wonderful. But I said to the producer, I said, look, I'd like to just go and see the treasures. And they said, well, no, the authorities are very worried about security because people have been killed recently, tourists. And if you were killed, this would not go down very well. So you'll have to go in an unmarked car. And you'll have to say to the you have to have one driver, not one driver there and one driver back, but one person with you.
Yes.
And they can drop you off at the Cairo Museum, and you can then come back to the hotel, which happens to be near the pyramids. Not on the list for some reason, but there we are. So I went there, and it was just so glorious because there's just dust everywhere, and they're about to move still are. In the process of setting up the new museum near the pyramids. Mm. So this was, you know, it was very much the sort of swan song of the Cairo Museum
yeah.
on the third floor. And I knew everything about it, but there was hardly anyone there. I just thought, oh, how terrific. Just, it again, out of this world.
Yeah.
Not part of the world that we know of you know, Greek and Roman and
yeah.
Renaissance and all this stuff. No, no, it's a completely, utterly different world of 1500, 1400 BC, and it is just so stunning. And the idea yeah. of Carter, who I then had to play in the film, so I was on a donkey at one stage being Howard Carter to get in the mood, as I explained. And the idea that he would peer in and see this 5,000 objects.
Well, other than seeing these particular objects of this particular, did it give you a wider interest in sort of Egyptology? Because it's a long period of time.
Yeah, it is a long
civilization. Yeah, hundreds, thousands of years.
I know, but there comes a point when I think I better just get back to Megre and. I can't do everything. Let's concentrate on a few things that I know I will enjoy. So, no, and all British politics. You know, there are some things that are coming at me all the time.
Yes.
I'm sure the Treasure of Tutankhamun is a wonder. It's out of this world, so on. But I can't devote too much time to that. I'll never be an expert. I'm too old.
Well, I you say that, but you could spend your time poring over the documents or reading a couple of books. I'm sure you'd mug up very quickly.
I would for a programme. If you're suggesting, Clive, that I could work with you on a programme about the treasure of Tutankhamun, on.
There's a suspicion that all your wonders have been either commemorating great TV series or perhaps trailing your coat, suggesting another one.
And I can't don't know how you could conceivably have that view, Clive. There must be something about you, something slightly sort of sinister, I think. Slightly underhand to even suggest something like that.
I think I'm trying to match up to your skills as an interviewer. Look, John Sargent, thank you very much for joining me on this podcast to select your seven wonders. I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it in this podcast. And they're all wonderful in their own way. I wonder if I should go back to the BBC, though, for your very beginning one. And just to make it clear in my mind what aspects of the BBC you are particularly describing as wonderful. Is it the whole package? Because you mentioned a couple of times the management and its problems and the structures.
Oh, yeah.
So do we have to endorse the management of the BBC to make this the wonder of wonders?
No. I mean, the thing is, let's take a great example of Greek sculpture, right? The Venus de Milo. How many arms has she got?
None.
So we're not talking perfection here. The BBC is riddled with all sorts of problems and difficulties and things that make you cross. And if you work in it, you're probably even more cross about all sorts of silly things. But the overall effect, despite everything,
yes,
that is what makes it so magnificent. And that's what, again, makes it out of this world. It's not normal.
All right. Well, on the basis that, as far as I can tell, apart from your very early life, everything, all the other wonders seem to come from working for the BBC or other broadcasters. I think the wonder of wonders that, anyway, I might have self-interest in this, I'll put the BBC as the wonder of wonders from your seven wonders. Thank you, John Sargent, for sharing your wonders with me.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.